in which the theme of the program is getting from where we are to the other side of this thing. Companies and people. From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, March the 26th, I believe. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A couple of years ago, October of 2017, if you're looking for a date, we did an interview with the CEO of the biggest hotel chain in the world. Arne Sorensen and I had a cup of coffee in the dining room of the Ritz-Carlton on Central Park South in New York City. Ritz is one of Marriott's brands. That's the company that Sorensen runs. And we had a long talk about the travel and hospitality business and what he saw from where he sat. Suffice it to say that that business looks really different right now. So we got Arne Sorensen on the phone to talk things over. Mr. Sorensen, it's good to have you back on the program again.
Thank you, Kai. Good to be with you again.
So I have to tell you, obviously, we've all been following the course of the economics of this crisis. I kind of realized it was going to get real serious when I saw Marriott come out and say, we are probably going to have to lay off tens of thousands of people. When did you know it was going to be serious?
Well, there was a sort of creeping sense for a few days that this was bad. We had a weekend, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, when the news left China and showed up in Korea and Italy. I think that was sort of filled with foreboding because it looked like it had left Asia and it was moving around the world. And it looked likely at that point in time that it was going to move into the United States in some manner. But it was in the week or maybe 2 weeks after that that we started to see business simply disappear.
You said on CNBC the other day, we want people to be strong enough when we reopen, which, yes, of course we do. But what does it look like to you that's going to make Marriott strong enough to reopen? Because there's months to go on this yet with nobody going to hotels.
Well, there's obviously a lot of uncertainty about when we start to tiptoe back out into life. I think even more importantly than that, and something we've spent an awful lot of time with in talking with politicians both on the Hill and in the administration the last few weeks, is let's make sure that the tools to support our people are set up to be available immediately to them at levels that allow them to survive, not have too much disruption in their lives, and so that they too are ready to get back.
Let me dip into the political here for just a sec, since you alluded to it. Are you satisfied that this $2 trillion from Congress is going to be enough, or are they going to have to go back to the well, as it were?
It is an 800-page bill that it won't surprise you to hear many of us have not read yet, and we're really trying to digest what is in there. I'm encouraged by what they've done with respect to the unemployment insurance scheme. I'm encouraged by what they've done in terms of loans to small businesses. And remember, many of our hotels are owned by third parties, virtually all of them, often run by those third parties, and they are small businesses. And then, of course, you've got some provisions on loans for others, including bigger companies. I'm not sure that we'll need any of those, but I think the tools that are in there are powerful. Biggest bailout of all time, obviously, $2 trillion. Do they have to go back to the well again? Maybe, but only if it lasts for probably more than a quarter or so, would be my guess.
Last thing, Mr. Sorensen, and then I'm going to let you go, and I'm going to take a turn to the personal here, and I'm just going to see how it goes. So you put out a video on Twitter a week ago today, which somehow seems like a really long time ago, to all Marriott employees. And we should say here, you are being treated for pancreatic cancer. You look like you are being treated for pancreatic cancer. And you said in the beginning of this video that your advisors had suggested you not do video maybe because of that. And you went on and you delivered a really sober but fundamentally uplifting message. But I want to get to the end of it. The thing ran like 5 minutes. And it was clear to me at the end that you got emotional. And I guess the question coming out of that is, are you scared?
I am. How to answer that question? I'm terrified of the impact to the thousands of people that we've got across the world who depend on the work that they do for us, for their livelihoods and for their families' livelihoods. And I'm terrified that they have the resources that they need in order to get through it. We're still early in this process. While furloughs have happened across the world and people are getting used to that, we're in the first week or two in the United States where that's the case. Now, we're a few months in advance of that across Asia Pacific, but the impact to people's lives will be profound. And we took three takes on that video, and I'll confess that I didn't choke up in exactly the same sentence every time, but I did choke up every one of the three times, and I wasn't intending to. And I said to the crew afterwards, figure out what you can use from that. But I choke up because I just think of the profound impact to the lives of folks who have zero responsibility for the crisis that we're in and who will pay a price which is much higher than they deserve to pay. They don't deserve to pay any price. And so we've got to find a way, communicating with them, being transparent with them, to get through this together. We will ultimately. People will come back to life because we're a resilient people all across the globe, including particularly in the United States. But we got to get there sooner rather than later in order to minimize the pain that so many will bear.
Arne Sorensen is the CEO of Marriott. Mr. Sorensen, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Guy.
On Wall Street today, Marriott shares didn't really do so well, but traders looked at that terrible number for first-time jobless claims that we got this morning, and they decided to buy anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, change of gears here. The mask and ventilator and personal protective equipment story you are up to speed on, right? Late start and denial at the national policy level means there isn't enough of anything at the tactical, seeing desperately sick patients every day level. As we've talked about on this program, that is a manufacturing problem to be sure. And as with most manufacturing problems, therein lies a supply chain problem. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on that one.
The shortages of important medical materials have inspired fear among many Americans. Michael Stumo is CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America.
We can't produce enough ventilators. We can't produce face masks. Hospital gowns are in sufficient quantities. Gloves. Most latex gloves are made in Malaysia.
Some countries, like China, haven't been able to produce what they normally export to us. Other places, like the European Union, have actively limited exports in an attempt to hoard supplies. Emily Blanchard is professor of economics at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. She says there is an upside to interdependence.
It also means potentially more resilience to shocks at home and in the rest of the world.
Having a diversified global supply chain can mean you have a lot of different backup sources, as long as governments don't throw up barriers.
If governments will stop raising barriers during the difficult times, then it's really not risky to depend on each other. And in fact, that's a great way for humanity to protect itself against something like a pandemic.
A bipartisan group of senators introduced legislation last week to start tackling the current supply problem. It would have pharmaceutical companies report to the FDA just how much of their active pharmaceutical ingredients they get from suppliers in different countries. Anand Nair is professor of operations and supply chain management at Michigan State University.
One needs to have a good understanding of what that capacity looks like. If, for instance, certain factory closures might happen due to kind of situation that we are facing now.
Finally, Dartmouth Blanchard says the U.S. should have better stockpiles of globally produced goods to hedge against catastrophe. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There is a huge part of this coronavirus story that is a data and yet a privacy story as well, and in ways that might not at first be apparent. Case in point, the Weather Channel. If you use its app, you might have seen there's a new tab right next to Daily Forecast and Radar that says COVID-19. The company, which is owned by IBM, has a new tool that lets users track reported cases of illness in their areas and zoom in elsewhere as well. Marketplace's Jack Stewart looks at tech in an outbreak.
I've been looking at the Weather Channel app obsessively today, watching the number of cases in my home county, Los Angeles, tick up to 799. Sherry Backstein is from the IBM subsidiary.
We are sourcing information from multiple government sources down to a county level.
And up to the World Health Organization. Harvard and Boston Children's Hospital developed another tracker, covidnearyou.org, that crowdsources symptoms that people enter, even if they haven't had a COVID-19 test. China, South Korea, and Taiwan have all been using cell phone location data to trace contacts between individuals in affected areas. David Lazar teaches information science at Northeastern University in Boston.
Norms and expectations about this differ from country to country, but in the U.S., I think it would be unacceptable to share identified individual-level data.
Italy, Germany, and Austria are using anonymized location data to see how well stay-at-home orders are working. Nina Pfefferman at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, says for this pandemic, honestly, we're likely past the point where tracking tools can help inform mitigation or containment plans. But
for next year, or as this goes forwards, hopefully everything calms down a bit, then these kinds of tools are really wonderful for complementing medical surveillance.
She does have a caveat. When sharing data about local outbreaks, education and context are crucial so that people aren't more worried than they need to be. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My branch's drive-up is still operational, so we are handling transactions through our drive-up, and we're wiping the tubes after every transaction.
Could be fast food, sure, but actually, banking in this coronavirus economy. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1,351 points today, 6.3%, 22,552. The NASDAQ up 413, that is 5.6%, 77.97. S&P 500 increased 154 points, 6.2%, 26.30 there. As we mentioned up at the top of the broadcast, real briefly, unemployment claims last week soared to 3.2 million. That is astronomical. So the states with the biggest increases in those claims for the week ending March 14th, which is the reference week, include California, big layoffs in the service industry there, Washington State, layoffs in transportation and warehousing, real estate and leasing as well, Pennsylvania, layoffs in accommodation and food service industries, transportation, also warehousing and education. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, y'all. I'm Rima Khreis, a host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. Right now, because of the global pandemic, both employers and employees are grappling with choices that may have felt unthinkable just a few weeks ago. So your company, how many employees do you have?
Well, up until Monday, there were 8 of us.
Oh, did you lay off someone?
I had to furlough everyone except for myself.
Oh, God.
So it's me. Hopefully I can pull out of the nosedive, but as of yesterday, it's me.
On this week's show, we hear from listeners about the painful decisions they're making. Subscribe to This Is Uncomfortable wherever you get your podcasts. New episode every Thursday about life and how money messes with it.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The House is going to vote tomorrow, we are told, on that rescue package. American businesses and American workers getting some of what they need to survive the next however many months this is going to last. Included for the first time in the unemployment safety net are gig workers, independent contractors. Call them what you will. Here to talk about those folks and how they are going to get by in this coronavirus recession is Marketplace's Chrissy Clark. She is the host of the documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Hey, Chrissy.
Hey, Kai. Greetings from my socially distanced makeshift home studio to yours.
Yes. Same. So look, this is season what? 4 now coming up of The Uncertain Hour, right?
Yep.
And you've been looking at contractors and gig workers in this economy. So how did it come to be that all of these people we are relying on during this crisis, how did they come to be considered not employees, but independent contractors in the first place?
Well, what you hear from business founders, from economists, is that employing people can be messy and it can be expensive to cover all the benefits that come with being an employee. So if you can figure out a way to set up a different arrangement to have your workers be independent contractors, that can, at least in the short term, help you be more flexible, more profitable. But then there are also all these social risks of having people not be considered employees, not get the employee safety nets that come with that status. And of course, gig workers and independent contractors are a really diverse group. Some make a lot of money, think lawyers and real estate agents. Some don't make much money at all, think Uber drivers and Amazon delivery people and even janitors. The thing that unites independent contractors is that they are not technically employees. They don't file W-2s at tax time. They file 1099s. And when you're not an employee, you don't have an employer who's paying into the government's unemployment system.
And that, of course, becomes relevant because if you're not paying in, you don't necessarily get benefits under the way things used to be. And we'll get to the rescue bill in a second. But, you know, you don't pay, you don't get, right?
Right. That's usually how it works. But these are not normal times. And so actually, part of the huge, huge stimulus bill that Congress is finalizing today will at least temporarily make independent contractors eligible for unemployment benefits if they've lost a job because of the coronavirus and its fallout.
And I don't want to make too much of this, but that, I mean, fundamentally, that's an economic lifesaver for a lot of these people.
Yeah. I mean, one thing to point out that labor advocates are pointing out is that, of course, companies like Uber and Lyft and other mobile platforms, they've not been paying into unemployment insurance funds. So the government will now be footing the bill for these payments. But still, just the idea of expanding it to independent contractors is a really big deal, especially because a lot of independent contractors are in pretty precarious financial situations. And we talked to a guy named Tice Moore from Denver who put all this in perspective. He's an independent contractor. He's had a steady gig with a property management company doing handyman stuff for Airbnb apartments, which, surprise, has not been getting a lot of bookings in the last few weeks. So Tice's work has almost completely dried up, and now he's not sure how he's going to make ends meet.
I mean, it's frightening. How am I going to get bills paid? How am I going to get rent paid?
Yeah, but that's not just independent contractors, right? Because I'm sure restaurant workers and bartenders and people who work in movie theaters, for instance, they're asking themselves the same question, right?
Absolutely. But there's this kind of extra fear that I think some independent contractors and gig workers face because of all of these gig-shaped holes in our social safety nets, holes that the coronavirus pandemic is really shining a light on. So independent contractors don't have access to this whole list of things: workers' comp, minimum wage and overtime protections, disability insurance, paid sick time, which is obviously a big thing these days. Even in the emergency sick leave measures that Congress passed last week that expanded paid sick time to many Americans if they have the coronavirus or have to care for someone who does, gig workers were mostly left out. They could be eligible for some tax relief at the end of the year to make up for unpaid sick days. But for people without a personal safety net, that might be too little too late.
Chrissy Clark, season 4 of the documentary podcast that we do here at Marketplace is called The Uncertain Hour. Coming, when's season 4 coming, Chrissy?
Soon.
Soon. We'll take soon. Look, it's different times. Different times. Chrissy Clark, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
So let's just preface this next story, shall we, with the observation that these are extraordinary times for everyone in this economy, and that before it's all said and done, we're eventually going to wind up hearing stories from great wide slices of the American workforce. Top of mind today are working parents. Schools are at least partially shut down in almost every state. More than 50 million kids have been sent home, which is complicating life for parents working inside and outside of the home. The situation is extreme, yes, but it's shining a spotlight on some challenges that were with us long before anybody had ever heard of coronavirus. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
For Jessica and Josh Witt, the boundaries between work and home are breaking down.
Every parent, I think, and every caregiver is going through that right now, trying to balance these things. And you know what? There's a little bit of okay, thank you.
In a minute, okay? Yeah.
She's going to need a potty break, sorry.
Jessica teaches biology at College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and Josh is a scientist at a pharmaceutical company, and this is Luella.
Hi.
How old are you?
3.
Their daughter, who's usually at preschool, is now their office mate, background music, chief distractor, and star of video conferences.
There are moments where my students see her like running in the background, or she'll come sit on my lap and I can hear her, "I need mommy. I want mommy. Mommy didn't give me a kiss. Good night."
Emily Oster, an economist at Brown, says scenes like that have become the norm in her conference calls.
Sometimes they're my children, sometimes they're other people's, and it's just sort of forced you to be able to say on the phone, honestly, something that I would have been very reluctant to do, that I am trying to, you know, manage my children, and I think we're going to see a lot of that.
In the U.S., 3/4 of mothers and more than 90% of dads work, and the challenges of doing both are out in the open like never before, says Bridget Schulte, the director of the Better Life Lab at the New America Foundation and author of Overwhelmed.
It's really, frankly, showing the illusion that we've been living under. This bizarre expectation that if you're a worker, you're all in, and that's all you are, and that's all you do. This sort of mass illusion that we don't have families, or that somehow we don't have these responsibilities.
And the pressure to keep family life out of work is particularly acute for women, says Caitlin Collins, a sociology professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
Women tend to be penalized for any signal that they are caregivers in the workplace, whereas men tend to receive benefits.
An analysis of census data by the National Women's Law Center found the wage gap is even wider between parents of different genders. Mothers are paid 69 cents for every dollar a father makes.
Women are considered somehow less committed or capable if they are parents, whereas men are seen as more committed and more capable to their jobs as parents.
Jessica and Josh Witt clearly don't see things that way, and they hope this crisis will be a turning point.
Because everyone is having to deal with it now, it is becoming okay, you know?
I mean, it's frustrating. It's hard, right? But I think it is important that if we're going to have a sustainable workforce, we need a workforce that's going to work with family life. You know, these issues are human issues.
Congress has already temporarily extended paid family and sick leave to millions of people. Some states are offering free childcare to frontline workers, and many employers have been forced to be more flexible about when and where work gets done. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
As of airtime for this radio program, there are stay-home orders in effect in 21 states. Hawaii, Idaho, Vermont, and Wisconsin joined the list yesterday. Colorado's order went into effect at 6 this morning, Mountain Time. Also this morning, Kate Bellino sent us an audio diary. She's a new accounts representative at a First Bank branch in Centennial, Colorado, just outside Denver. Kate's one of the people we're profiling in our series, The United States of Work.
It is 7:19 this morning, and I'm currently getting ready to get to work. I have a letter stating that it's okay for me to be out because I'm going to an essential workplace. We have closed our lobbies. We are taking appointments, 1 to 2 customers at a time, but we're really limiting the amount of people who come into our lobbies other than the employees. My branch's drive-up is still operational, so we are handling transactions through our drive-up, and we're wiping the tubes after every transaction. We are cutting our teams in half, but everybody is still getting paid, which is amazing. Nobody's being laid off. Nobody's worrying about a paycheck. Being on this end of things has been interesting, to say the least. There's a lot of people my age and younger and older who I just don't think are taking this seriously enough. We will all get through this. We just have to put away our selfishness for a little bit. And in the meantime, your banks are still working for you.
That's Kate Bellino at First Bank Colorado, one of the many people still literally on the job while parts of this economy shut down around them. You can share the stories of your coronavirus economy at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, hat tip to one of our Friday regulars, MSNBC's David Gura. It's in keeping with that idea of getting through to the other side of this thing that I talked about right at the beginning. Fitch, the credit ratings people, sent out a note today. Here's the headline. Fitch affirms United States at AAA outlook stable. Now, it's not all sunshine and light. They are worried about the debt and deficit. The economy is going to shrink this year, they say. But, you know, hope. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 1,351 points today, 6.3%. The NASDAQ up 413, that is 5.6%. The S&P 500 increased 154 points, 6.2% on that particular index. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Rick Carr, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.